This episode of Harvey Brownstone Interviews is brought to you by the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend Coffee, available at HollywoodBlends.com. Everyone's saying it's the best coffee they've ever tasted. Why not give it a try and see for yourself?
Hello, everyone. I'm Harvey Brownstone, and today's special guest is an immensely popular celebrity chef, author, restaurateur, fitness authority, and humanitarian who has become a global sensation with his hugely successful TV shows, Dinner Impossible, Restaurant Impossible, Restaurant Rivals, Cheat Day USA, The Globe, Kitchen Expedition, and Restaurant Express. Our guest also oversees a whole slew of companies, including restaurants, frozen foods, liquor, and protein bars, in addition to having his own free digital magazine that provides inspirational workouts, recipes, and motivational articles. He's written 5 books: Mission Cook, Impossible to Easy, Fit Fuel, Family Table, and his latest book, which I absolutely devoured, entitled Overcoming Impossible: How to Lead, Build a Team, and Catapult Your Business to Success, in which our guest shares the vitally important lessons he's learned from his vast experience, both in building his own businesses and helping hundreds of others fix theirs. And when he's not filming his TV show or working overseas with the USO, he goes on tour with a highly entertaining, unpredictable, and interactive traveling live show. And one of the most impressive and commendable qualities of our guest is his tireless passion for philanthropy. A significant portion of the proceeds from all of his endeavors go to his own foundation, which gives back to our servicemen and women and first responders in a variety of ways: training service dogs, making mental health and wellness services available to veterans in need, providing mobility devices for the disabled, and much more. For his monumentally important charitable work and public service, our guest has received dozens of prestigious accolades and awards, most notably being named Honorary Chief Petty Officer of the United States Navy and receiving the Medal of Honor Society's Bob Hope Award. He received the Outstanding Civilian Service Award from the U.S. Army, the Spirit of Hope Award from the U.S. Department of Defense, and in 2023, he was the very first recipient of the Veterans of Foreign Wars Distinguished Citizenship Award. He's also an ambassador of the Culinary Institute of America, and he received the Culinary Excellence Award from the Culinary Institute of America and the American Tasting Institute. I'm delighted and honored to welcome a true superstar, Robert Irvine, to our show. Chef Robert, thank you so much for being here.
I can't wait. Listen, I've heard that you are this amazing interviewer, but also you do a lot of research. So I'm excited to see what you're going to throw at me.
I can't wait to. Okay, here we go. You joined the Royal Navy in England at the age of 15, which is extremely young. What made you do that?
So it was actually 15 and a half years old. Long story cut short. My mother was going to work on a bus. I would wave in a shirt and tie like you are, that was a secondhand from Oxfam. You call it Goodwill here. I would go back to the house with my friends and drink my dad's beer. She called the house. I answered the phone. Demise of Robert Irvine. Took me to the recruitment office. My father was in the army. My brother was in the army. I was already in Sea Cadets, traveling the weekends, going to bases and doing these great things on ships that were active duty. And I fell in love with the ocean. So the Navy was my, sign me up. I'll go.
That's amazing. And did you already have a love of cooking at that age?
Yeah, I started home economics at school because I thought it would be a good way to get a girlfriend. It was me and 30 girls in a class. I was pretty blown away that my first dish was a quiche Lorraine. I was amazed that that could change people's mood and, you know, food could drop the barriers of kids and people and just make it easier to converse. I fell in love with that when my mother took me, as I just told you. There was a maths and English test, 1 being the highest, 5 being the lowest. I got 5-5, and the recruitment officer said to me, "Well, Sonny, you're in the Majesty's Royal Navy. Congratulations. And you're going to be a cook. Congratulations." And I went, woohoo, you know, because I love food. And he thought I was, you know, like this monster with three heads, thinking, why would you want to be a cook in the Navy? But I loved
Could you
it.
ever imagine when you decided to take home economics only because it was a good way to meet girls, that one day that would be the foundation of your entire career?
No. Look, I come from a very, very humble family. You know, my father was a great football player in the army. My brother was in the army. Wasn't for me. I love the ocean. The leadership part, I already think I had. I was bored at school, except home economics, woodwork, history, sports. I was really good at sports. And I had a tutor, a senior tutor, who named David Bodfish, who passed away about 10 years ago. But he saw that I had something that was unique. And he would send me, even though my mother and father couldn't afford it, he paid for it, right? He would send me on a school ship in Malta for 2 weeks, a camp in Rumsey, or Mountbatten of Burma's estate. So he paid for that because he saw that there was something good. I wish he was alive today to see what that belief did, because we couldn't afford that.
I'm sure that somewhere he does know. So what would you say was the biggest lesson the military taught you that you still apply in the kitchen and in business today?
Well, I think leadership number one, and loyalty. You know, when we think of leadership, there are many facets to leadership. As a leader, not a boss, two different things. A leader is giving you the vision of where you need to go, giving you the tools to do what you need to get there, allowing you the space to converse and also listen, right? And if you give those four kind of things, people can guide themselves. And when they get stopped, they're not afraid to come to you. When they get stuck, I'm sorry. They're not afraid to come to you and say, hey, I've hit a stumbling block here. But you have to allow them to be themselves and try and figure the problem out to get to the end solution. And let me kind of go a little deeper there. I look at the mountain of Everest, and my goal is the top of that mountain. I don't go from the base to the top. I go from the top to the bottom, reverse thinking. There's my goal. And how do I get there? By reversing the situation, because that's how we do it in the military. We don't say, oh, we're going to do this. We say, oh, there's where we want to be, and this is how we're going to get there. And I think that was a big lesson for me in the leadership. And more frequently, or more recently, I should say, not frequently, but listening is a tough skill I've had to master. I wasn't good at it before. Loyalty, I've always been good at. I'm loyal to it. The day is long, and my wife will tell you that sometimes I'm too loyal, right? But look, in 16 years of all of the companies that we have, 18 whatever companies we have, over 8,000 employees, we've lost three in that amount of time, right? Because they couldn't do what they said they can do. And my wife, by the way, here's a note to self. My wife told me not to hire them in the first place because she didn't get a good vibe, and I should have listened.
But that's a pretty good track record, I'll tell you. That shows incredibly good judgment and instincts about people. So something intuitive. So, Chef, was there one defining moment in your early years that really shaped your philosophy or your strategy of what you wanted your career to be?
No. I think it's been a my life, and it still is to this day. You know, I'm almost 60 years old, so I started when I was young. But my life is... has been drifting, right? I believe the biggest part of my success is relationships. And not only with my wife, that's given, but the relationships you build with people at the beginning, when they're, you know, the same guy as you are, but all of a sudden their trajectory, you know, goes up and up and up and up and up, and they're CEOs and they remember you. And I say this to people and young people and businesses that we have, whether it's drones, whether it's clothing, whether it's all the things that we do. Don't try and sell something. Build a relationship and have a cup of coffee and listen to what they are trying to do and then interject how you can help or maybe help or know somebody that can help. And I think those are not innate in us. We normally, like, my wife will always say to me, oh, you dominate a room and you should be quiet sometimes, right? And I'm like, well, there's times you dominate a room, there's times you're quiet. And that's something I've learned in business. There's no defining moment, except I would say the relationships I built are over a beer, a glass of tequila at an event that I'm at or hosting or cooking or whatever. Never on a golf course, although I know it's done on a golf course, but really getting to know somebody, and it may be over a meal that I cooked. And I just did a big dinner with Dean Kamen, the inventor, which I love, a couple of days ago, and met another 12 people who are another extension of my network now. So I think that was my biggest lesson. And then not being afraid to go into something that I don't know. For an example, I cook, but I'm into drones, I'm into humanoids, I'm into nutrition, I'm into food, I'm into military clothing, I'm into backpacks, I'm into bomb suits. All those things that you would never associate with me, but we do them. So if you don't know, meaning me, how to do that, I have to bring in somebody smarter than me in each of those areas to help me. I'm a quick study, but I also believe that there are people out there a lot smarter than me. I have two amazing corporate chefs that travel the globe leapfrogging each other, and a whole line of military chefs also that are way better than me. And I'm okay with that. I'm not worried. So there goes another part of leadership where the ego gets in the way and it stops forward motion. So I think, again, no defining moment to your question, but a continual learning every day of people that maybe sweep in the street, cook on the line, somebody serving me a cup of coffee. There's always a, wow, that was really great service. How are they achieving that? Or, wow, there's really great this. Or this is really bad. So I look at that every day, even in my own world.
It's incredibly impressive, because what you're really talking about is a highly attuned set of interpersonal skills, with a natural curiosity, with a lack of egotism, an interest in learning. It's really quite amazing. Now, you worked on the Royal Yacht Britannia as a young man. How much contact did you have with the royal family?
All the time. In fact, I wish I could. I've got it on here. So years and years ago, there was no iPhones, right? I met Prince Charles when he was learning to fly a helicopter, whereas my wife was first stationed in Royal Naval Air Station called Rose when I was just over 16 years old. And that's how I met, got to go on the Royal Yacht and do all these things. But when I look at that, was that meant to happen? Yes. I believe the serendipity. I believe in people connecting on a whole different level. I believe in, I'm meant to meet you at a certain time in a certain place. I got to do that every day. And in fact, on June the 3rd this year, I took 65 veterans on the Catamaran Yomp, which is a big march that celebrates the march from San Carlos to Port Stanley in the Falkland Islands during the Falklands War. So there's 65 United States folks from us, veterans, and 1,300 coalition. But at the beginning of that, when we landed in Edinburgh, the Royal Yacht Britannia is now a museum. So I took the team to the museum, and it was funny. We had a personal tour and a breakfast and all that kind of thing. And the guy was giving the tour, and I kept interrupting him. And the end of it, he said, you know what, why don't you just give the tour? You know, so we went into places where I worked, in the galley and the Royal Galley and all those kind of things. That was a special time of my life, and it still is. But I couldn't share that with him because we had service records. But what I didn't have was pictures, because we didn't have these. You know, there was a lot of controversy of, well, Robert didn't do this, right? Even though I had records and I was working at the White House and doing all these things that I did. But I'll show you somebody sent this to my info chef Irvine not so long ago. And there, I don't know if you can see that. That is the Prince of Wales on my right, but probably your left, Charles and Diana there. And right in the back there, behind this tall guy, let me see if I can squeeze that out a little bit there. That's me right there.
Oh, my heavens. There right. You are. So, did you like the royal family?
I love them. I still love them. And you know, it's like the heads of state I cook for, whether it be Bush's, Obama's, Clinton's. I was with Joe Biden, Jill Biden, since they were senators. President Trump, I worked for at Trump Taj Mahal for many years. So, you know, I wouldn't want their positions of anybody's shop.
But when you're cooking for presidents and prime ministers and royalty and celebrities, how do you come up with a menu when you're cooking for such high profile people?
It depends on their likes, their dislikes, their cultures, what they can and can't have. There's a lot goes into it, for sure.
Have you ever been intimidated by any famous person?
No, I've done the Academy Awards. I'm not intimidated by anything, but what I am is a perfectionist, right? So we finish an event and we'll go with a team and have a drink at a bar somewhere, and I'll rework that whole event and say, we could have done this, we should have done that. So I'm my own worst critic. I don't need anybody else to tell me. Everybody else doesn't know what I know in my thought process. So I want it to be better every time. And I have an amazing team of people that they're as dedicated as I am. You know, I'm on the road 345 days a year, 150 of those just with the military. Today I'm home. Literally, I just got back from a tour from England, Scotland, straight into Philadelphia, to Alabama, to LA. I'm here today. Monday, I'll be in Rota, Spain, Sigonella, Italy, Tuesday, and Wednesday in Catania, Sicily. So, but I love it. It's something that I know we can make a difference with. We're going to make a difference. So that schedule interferes with my family life, my wife, my kids. But they understand, you know, this is my passion. Food is not my passion, Harvey. You have to understand, food is a passion, but not my passion. My passion is the military. And I'm allowing food to be the vehicle that gets me to that passion.
No, that makes perfect sense. And it totally encompasses and encapsulates what you're all about. But since you did mention food, do you have one dish that you consider to be your signature dish that perfectly represents your style as a chef?
No. If you said to me, here's a bunch of ingredients, or here's the Prime Minister of India, I can make anything. I'm not afraid. I've pretty much been disciplined in classical French cuisine, but I've been traveling the world for, you know, 345 days for the last 16 years of that intensity, and have cooked for everybody and everything everywhere. So for me, it's the fun piece of, okay, and I give you an idea. I was in a village with 2,000 women shooting Kitchen Expedition, talking about how salt used to be more expensive than gold per ounce. And that was the dowry, and I cooked for 2,000 women. I went to a market that was 54 miles square, you know, not like we know, but with carcasses and fish and flies and everything else. And I made the meal in the middle of nowhere with nothing. And all the 2,000 women, and you can watch it on Kitchen Expedition on Discovery, were blown away that a man is cooking. It was amazing.
I can't wait to watch that. On Restaurant Impossible, you took struggling restaurateurs who were under intense pressure mentally and financially. You transformed their restaurants into successful businesses. Was there a single theme that kept recurring in those cases that gave you the key to turning them around?
Yes. And there's a couple, not just one. So I would, and this is a true statement, I never knew what I was walking into. In Dinner Impossible, Restaurant Impossible, or any other show, I chose that as I want to hear it from the people themselves, why they're in a bind, or why there are $350,000 or $1,000,001 is the highest we've been in debt. I want to hear it from them. So I would walk in, the crew would get there the day before, they would do the B-roll stuff, set up the tents, et cetera, et cetera. I would walk in the morning of day two, which is my day one, 8 o'clock, they would tell me the issue, I would ask questions. And the biggest two things I would always come up with was family members and no leadership. Then you throw in no chef or no idea. Then you look at the service. Then you look at what kitchen equipment they have that works and the amount of steps to go into that menu that that chef has to make to put that plate on a press, how long it takes, all those things that I do just naturally, but that's in every business I look at. I'm a systems guy. How does it work? Why does it work? And what was your original idea? Because somebody opens a restaurant, does this typically, Harvey. They say, okay, I'm going to open a restaurant. They have no knowledge. They hire a chef that has a good resume, maybe, whatever, or sold them a bill of goods, whatever. And 2 months later, 3 months later, they've invited all the friends to drink, eat, and for free. And they realize they're $300,000 in debt. And they don't know why. Because they've never worked in a restaurant or run a P&L in most cases. Although I did have one guy who started his own business that used to be a multi-unit operator for another big company, 13 restaurants. And he couldn't run one because he didn't understand the profit and loss statement. He didn't understand the purchasing, the cooking, the steps, all those things I just mentioned. And they failed because there was no leadership. There was no direction. They allowed an employee, meaning the chef or a manager, they allowed them to run it instead of them being present. And that's the biggest failure in business today, no matter whether it's a podcast, a trucking, a fuel station, a restaurant, Walmart, it doesn't matter. Unless there is somebody there with a vision to do this and giving directions and following up, businesses fail. And that's why I think up until COVID, we were about 76% successful. COVID killed everything, except we did 68 episodes of filming during COVID on 4 buses and 2 trucks. My biggest successes are people who listen, and I can tell you $1.1 million in debt in Cerritos, California, in a strip mall. Daughter, grandmother, and mother were $1,000,001 in debt, and then I do $3.4 million. I talk to them every week. There's one in New Hampshire named Jen, husband and wife, hate each other, divorced, had to stay together because they were in debt by almost $400,000. But the restaurant was in a beautiful location on a river, covered bridge. I mean, it's movie stuff. We redid that. And on day two, it was called the covered bridge. Now it's called something else, but it was a covered bridge. Still the same owner. But they couldn't get on. I said, one of you has got to sign over the debt. And he says, well, I'm not doing it. I'll sign the debt over to her. I said, great. And she said, I don't want to take the debt because that's a lot for me. And I said, well, I'll support you. She signed the debt. We got a lawyer to ratify it. Everything came into her name. Now she's doing $3+ million a year. I talk to her every week. So those people that listen do very well. But those people that don't...
Well, the thing for me about Restaurant Impossible that makes the show so watchable and appealing was that you were always so obviously right about the advice you gave. It made such good sense. But I'm wondering, Chef, in all those years and all those episodes, was there ever an instance where you regretted the advice you gave?
No.
That's phenomenal, don't you think?
Well, look, here's the thing, Abby. I've set up, oh my goodness, I can tell you thousands of restaurants, whether it be for Donald Trump, I used to run his casinos, whether it be for you know, independent restaurants, Caesars, Marriott, whoever. I know what success is and I know how to build a kitchen and a team for success, because it's not just the food. If the servers don't do their job, the food doesn't matter. right? If the ambience isn't good and the bathrooms aren't clean, you're not going into a restaurant. So if a girl stood at the front and she's chewing gum and on her phone, you're going to walk right out. So it's a holistic approach to looking at, and that's why I do the service in the show. I want to see how it works, how they work it, and then how I would change it to be successful. The amount of steps the chef takes from the refrigerator to the pan, where the pan's located, all those things play a part in the success of that person. And that's not just that. That's a drone company, a clothing company. It's systems and leadership skills that make you successful.
So let me ask you this. What do you really think of the restaurant rating system, especially the Michelin stars? Is that system really fair, or has it become political?
I think it's become political now. I think it used to be a lot more stringent than it is. It's not for me. I couldn't do, you know, those things that they ask. I know 3-star Michelin chefs that are absolutely amazing, that deserve 3 stars. Then I think, oh, I go to them myself. I'm not a fan of them because I think it's too pomp and circumstancy for me when I want to eat something that's just, look, I go into a restaurant and people are like, oh, ugh. And they want to send out 1,000 things, which is great. But then when I order something and it takes so long because they want it to be perfect, and it's never going to be perfect except the day you put it in and you do it the way you normally do it instead of trying to change something for me. It's like me cooking for a president. I can't change my style. I do what I do because I have a system. You, me, my wife, this is the system. This is, we clean up as we go, all those things. And that the minute somebody famous walks into a restaurant, the chef suddenly goes, oh my goodness, No, do what you do and do it well and you'll be successful. Whether it's for the president of the United States, whether it's for whoever, do what you do. And I think that's the biggest problem with businesses. They change based on who walks in the door, and there's no need to do that.
As you know, Chef, in recent years on TV, there's been a proliferation of food competition, reality shows. I mean, the public's learning a lot more than ever before about what it takes to be a good chef. But in your opinion, have those TV shows been a good thing for the food industry?
I don't think so. You'll never see me. I did Worst Cooks in America. I didn't like it because I had people judging me that have no right judging me. Right? Because they're celebrities. I don't go into a movie and say, oh, you did this line wrong or you did this character wrong. I would have somebody say, oh, by the way, and this is common knowledge for me and people know this, oh, we need a little bit more salt. You know, no, this is the way I designed it. This is, so I don't do competition shows because I made it very clear and I was very upset with two I did on Food Network and they know what it was. And sometimes they, you know, it's like when you take a real story, you know, of in history, and then Hollywood gets hold of it and changes it, right? You can't do that. History is history, no matter what. And we have to live with that. You know, Audie Murphy is a great movie about him and a tank. You know, and he became a Medal of Honor recipient because of that. Holding off a battalion of German panzers. That's a true story. And he did. He snuck out the bottom of the tank, buried himself in mud, and an SS officer looked underneath and saw him, and that SS officer was retreating and could have shot him, and he didn't. And that's a true story. But the way it was glamorized is the way I feel with food competition shows. Look, if they don't make it, don't give them 5 more minutes. Get them done. If you watch me on TV, I'm the same human being. You don't do your job, I mean your face. You do your job, I give you a pat on the back. People know who I am. I'm very realistic. Even in my day life, my wife will say to me sometimes, "Hey, I'm not one of your employees. I'm your wife." I'm like, "Well, you got to do this. You got to do this. You got to do this."
Well, now that you mentioned that, many of the celebrity chefs we've seen on TV, like Gordon Ramsay, appear to be extremely aggressive, sometimes to the point of harassment of their staff. What's your take on that kind of behavior?
It's not him. I'm telling you that right now. If you look at his track record with people that work with him, and I've met Gordon once. I don't know Gordon. I'm not, you know, I did Dinner Impossible, Restaurant Impossible, way before this was ever a thing on TV. So I consider me being the first of that. I think it's TV-ism. I think it's because that's what the American viewers or the worldwide viewers, you know, if you think of Gordon, he's 29% of Fox's total television. He's an amazing chef. I mean, he was taught by Marco Pierre White, you know, a three-star. I mean, he's worked in, he's got the chops way more than I will ever have. I mean, the documentated show, look, I cook for a living. I look up to him because he's a chef. Can he cook better than me? I don't know, is the answer. But has he got Michelin stars? Yes.
But you're saying it's all an act. It's just for entertainment value.
Yeah, I think it's entertainment. I don't think it's real. I mean, the days of, and look, when I worked in kitchens, the days of chefs throwing pots and pans and tantrums and knives, it was real. Not anymore. We can't do that anymore because there's labor laws. There's all those things. So I think if you ask me, his best, Gordon, and I loved the F word he had in England. It was not the F word, but it was the food word. It was one of the best shows I've ever seen. And I wish he'd bring that back because that was to me, look, now he's got all these other shows. That's fine. I was the first. I was doing it first. He's doing it now. So I think he's a great guy. I don't think he is what you see. I see him with people on TV that he's very different with. So I don't think he's that. I've got friends that work with him that love him. So I think it's not who he is. I think it's an entertainment thing. Yes, totally.
So we have to take those shows with a grain of salt. So chef, when you're training and mentoring young chefs in your kitchen, do you sometimes have to undo the lessons they learned in culinary school?
I tell people this, I love culinary schools, right? But what you learn are the basics in culinary schools. It's not what's really happening in, you know, any kitchen. You learn the mother sauces, you learn how to cut, dice, slice, da-da-da. That's the same no matter where you go, except if you go into a Michelin-style kitchen, then it's like, you know, it's more than I would do. But I tend to find, I'm like, look, don't try and be Gordon. Don't try and be me. Don't try and be Marco Pierre. Don't try and be the Rue brothers. Just find your rhythm and be okay with making mistakes. Now, you make a mistake once, I'm okay with the mistake. I'll go back, I'll retrain you. But if you make a mistake twice, then maybe you're not meant to be in this business. Or any business, by the way. I allow mistakes because I make mistakes all the time, even at 60 years old. But don't make the same mistakes twice because that shows that you're being inconsistent, you're being complacent, you're being, you know, if you really focus on your job, no matter what it is, you'll get better and better. And I do this thing on a stage. I have a live show that travels the world, literally. And they blindfold me, they headfold me, and people start to cook a meal. And I have 6 minutes to whatever they've made in one pot, by the way, Cheerios, ham hocks, you name it. I have to make a meal out of that in 8 minutes, 6 or 8 minutes. And I don't know what they put in until I taste it, right? You should be able to cook on anything with anything and make anything if you're that good. And I believe that the more you practice, the more you move. And I'm not a big fan of people staying 3 or 4 years in a location. I never have been, never will be. Until you get to my age, then it's different. But as a young cook, you should be getting as much experience. You should be going to France. You should be going to Italy. And people say, well, we can't afford it. Well, look, find a restaurant, call them, camp on the doorstep, say I'll work for 3 months for free, and learn that business because that's what we do. And I think that's where you then get the great jobs in great restaurants with great chefs. And eventually, if you want to open your own place, great. I'm not that guy. I have one restaurant inside the Pentagon, but I serve the biggest and most important people in the world. And I'm not a Michelin star restaurant.
Well, I want to ask you a question now, sir, that has been put to me by at least four people that I know who own restaurants, they've all asked me to ask you this question. As you know, working in the food industry, especially in a restaurant, is such a demanding profession because of the long hours. It's difficult to have any kind of family life. What do you say to chefs and restaurant workers who are having trouble with work-life balance?
There is no such thing. And that's not just the restaurant and hospitality workers. That's anybody that's a type A personality, and I'm one, you're one.
How could you tell?
Steve's one. Here's the thing. I've worked around a lot of people. I've got some great friends. Brandon Braga, who's a movie producer, series producer. I do his rap parties at the end of these movies and shows. When you are so dedicated to your craft, there's no such thing as work-life balance. And that's why you see, especially in the hospitality industry, because what do? We go in early in the morning. We work late at night. Then you can't unwind and go to bed. You have to go for a beer or something to eat with your friends. Then it's 2 o'clock in the morning. Then you're back in at 9, 10, 11, 12, whatever it is. Look, you've got to find somebody that has the same intensity. And I use that word very intentionally. Intensity as you. People say to me, oh, when you go into a Restaurant Impossible, you go into a business, sometimes you're mean. And I say, no, I'm not mean. I'm not demeaning. I'm intense because I have a certain amount of time to find out information, to judge where I think is going wrong, and then to put systems in place to fix that. In any company, and I work with a lot of Fortune 500 companies, not just food, talking airlines and all those kind of things. Intensity is tough, and a lot of people can't deal with that. I've got a wife who's a wrestler from Toronto, was a wrestler, I should say, now she does TV. She's intense as me. I like that. So we get on really well.
Say intense, is that another word for ambitious, driven, very focused?
I think focused and driven, not ambitious. This is the problem I feel. Young people are so ambitious. They went to get to the top. So they'll say, oh, I want to be on TV. Well, I was 42 years old before I hit TV. I was an executive chef for many years, from my 30s to get to 42 before I even pitched the show. And I wrote the show. The show didn't define me. The kitchen practices defined me. So I wasn't ambitious to get on TV. Somebody asked me to do something. I did it. Great. But the business aspect for me was more important. When you have, and I talk about this in the book, when you have one L, meaning loss, it's tough. You have to step back and go, how did I fail and why did I fail? But you may have 17 L's and one W, a win, and that one win negates that 17 losses because you learned the lessons of those losses to get that win. So I would say definitely I'm not ambitious. Things come to me and I decide, do I want to do them or not? At my age now, and by the way, I don't turn anything down. That's my problem. I say, yes, there's a problem. I'll fix it. And I love that because I like the intensity of going in somewhere with a timeline of getting stuff done and delivering something.
So have I got this right? If someone were to say to you, you know, I'm really in love with owning a restaurant and I really want to do it and I'm very passionate about serving great food, but I would like to spend more time with my children and my family and have vacations and maybe not work on weekends, would you say to them, look, this business doesn't allow for that?
I would exactly say that. I would say go and cook in an old people's home. And there's nothing wrong with that, by the way. There's some great chefs there. They don't work on weekends. They're home 9 to 5-ish. But this business is not meant for you.
I think that's brilliant, actually. What you're saying is find an avenue where you can use your talent, but do it in an atmosphere that's more suitable to what your priorities are. That's brilliant.
Harvey, I can't work in a kitchen anymore, and I haven't for 20-some years, right? Going to work and doing a shift. I've been my own boss for that long. And I do what I do, and I travel the globe fixing these things. And I wouldn't want anything different, even at 6 years old. I work 18 hours a day, not every day, but most days. I live on a plane. And if my wife couldn't deal with that, number one, I wouldn't be married. And she knew that going into, you know, I was very clear. Look, you have a job. I have a job. What we'll do is, I will support your passion. You have to support my passion. And somewhere in the middle of those passions, we will meet and we will spend time together. That's the only way you can do. My wife was literally last week in Whistler, Vancouver, with her friends from some TV shows, while I was on the other side of the world. And then we come together and we make it work. And that's something that you have to find. And you're not going to find it in the hospitality industry if you're both in it, because it doesn't work. Find something that fits your lifestyle of your kids, your wife, your significant other, whatever. But don't get into this crazy business of, oh, I want to be an executive chef of 14 hotels, because it's going to consume you. It will. My life is consumed. Luckily, I have a sauna and a cold plunge I can switch off. But my wife knows that. My kids know that. It's been from day one. I've been very transparent. And I think that's the important piece. And I learned this a long time ago. I used to say to Gail, my wife, I would say, oh, I'll be home in an hour. And then 4 hours later, I would show up. And she's like, well, what happened to the hour? I have no concept of time. Any day to me is from morning till night and ends in Y. There's no work day. So if I get a call at 2 o'clock in the morning from Korea, which I do, my wife sleeps with headphones on. I pick up the phone because it's important with my military work or whoever, wherever it is, because somebody's life depends on that.
It's an incredible intensity that you've been able to sustain for many years. I want to ask you about your latest book, Overcoming Impossible. And I want to say to our viewers, this book has so many lessons in it that are far beyond the food industry. It's about business and leadership. But I want to quote you something that you wrote in your latest book that really struck me, Chef. You said, and I'm quoting you here, "It may very well be that what motivates your employees is totally unrelated to the business you're in, and there's no way to encourage them to express their creativity and pursue those passions through their work for you. But it's perfectly reasonable that you show an interest in what interests them." My question to you, sir, is how does it make sense investing in someone who's not really interested in your business?
Because you have to understand them. They're like children. What motivates one person for example, me that loves to cook, right? What motivates me in cooking, and you're working alongside me, you may want to be a travel agent in 2 years from now. If I invest time in you and help you, you're going to become a loyal employee. And let me go a little one step further why I wrote that. I have to know every person of those 8,000 people that I employ, right? They're my team members. They're my associates. They're my friends. If I have somebody walks into the office or walks into the kitchen or walks into a drone company and I say, hey, good morning, and I see this face, they say hi, and I say, hey, what's going on? Oh, nothing. Well, no, there's something going on. Meaning, Harvey has an autistic son. The autistic son is having an issue. I've got to know that. Why? Because when I say to you, hey, is it, I'm using Steve now, but how's Steve doing, your son? And you're like, he's having a little episode, he's doing this. I say, you know what, Harvey, go home, take care of business. When you're ready, you come back. I'm going to pay you. Just take care of your family. What does that do? It shows that I care about you. It shows that I care about your family. And you, in return, are going to be the loyal employee. Whether you want to be a cook or not, you're going to show up every day. You're going to give your best until you come to me and say, hey, Robert, I really wanted to be this travel agent. And I say, you know what? You've been a great employee. You've helped me. I'm going to help you get that next job. And by the way, That happens with me every time. I don't lose people, but if people come to me and say, I want to do this, I'm like, well, let me help you do it because you've done a good job. But focus on the job you're doing here. And I say this to leaders all the time. Look at the people who make you successful. We are successful because of that we, not I. There's no I in team, right? You hear that all the time. That's a very kind of thing. But together, everyone achieves more. That's what team means.
And that's one of the reasons I really want people to understand how important this book is. I'm going to tell you something else. A statement you made in the book that resonated with me. You said, often lost amid the minutiae of how to build a business is the crucial question of why you want to build a business. Are you just doing it for the money or the notoriety? Or are you genuinely attempting to add value to people's lives? The reason you're doing something can mean the difference between being happy or miserable, and it will ultimately mean the difference between success and failure. So my question to you, in your experience, sir, do a lot of people go into businesses, including restaurants, for the wrong reasons?
Totally. Because they see dollar. Look, any business you go into is tough, from a startup to a multi-million dollar to a multi-billion dollar. It gets tougher as you go along. But that has to be, why do you do what you do, or why do you want to get into it? I'll give you an example. 2013, I was doing a live show in Pittsburgh. A guy called my assistant and said, hey, I wanted VIP tickets to this live show. It's pretty crazy. For his kids, they're big fans of Restaurant Impossible. One was 6, one was 8. And I said, you know what, just bring the kids. I love kids. Don't worry about it. We've come as my guests. We'll figure it out, whatever. So prior to the show, I was sitting on the floor in my dressing room with 2 kids I didn't know and a dad that I didn't know, just talking to the kids. He said, oh, I've got a protein bar company. And I said, okay, I love protein bars, but I hate all of them. They all suck. I end up getting into business with him, and it became a huge business. So why did I get into that? Number one, I'm a fitness freak. Number two, I thought there was a place in the marketplace that the void will be filled by having a good tasting protein bar, and it would do good things for people trying to lose weight, gain weight, all those things. Forget the money. Because I put $463,000, that was my whole life, into something that I believed we could change the world. And we did, by the way. So you've got to be passionate about people. And that's not just about food or what, why. And I had a call this morning with a very special guy. I won't tell his name, but he's a special operations guy and goes into places so that we can do what we do, right? One of them special guys. And he's about to get out in March. And I said the same thing. I said, what do you want to do now? You've done all these amazing things and kept countries safe. And literally, I can't tell you what he does, but amazing guy. I said, well, he's just said, I want to continue to help people. I said, but then you're going to be successful no matter what. No matter what you do, you've got the experience. I'll help you do this, whatever you want to do. But he has a passion for people because that's what the military teaches you. Whether you come from Alabama, Rhodesia, England, our US military is made up of a gambit of people with all different financial means. Some come from homes, some come from homeless, some come from broken homes, all those things. And yet we have the best military in the world because we put time and effort into those people. And that's what I care about. So the excitement for me is taking a young person and molding them. And we do it at Fort Jackson. We do it at Paris Island. We take somebody with long, shaggy hair. We shave their head day one. We teach them to march in week one. We teach them to run and whatnot in week one. And then 10 weeks later, we get a soldier, male or female, that come out of there disciplined, ready to go, and ready. And they may say, oh, you know what? I'm going to do 1 or 2 years. They end up doing 30, 35 years later, they come out, right? And our world is a better place because of those people, our firefighters, our police officers. You know, it really upsets me when I see people, oh, defund this and do this. And I don't get political. I just know that if somebody breaks into my house, I call 911. If my house gets on fire, I call 911. Somebody shows up. These are the men and women that go to work every day for other people. 9/11, the same thing. Minneapolis, all these things that we're seeing, I want to make it better for them. And everything in my body, blood, bones, life is geared towards doing better for somebody that needs my help.
Now, it's very, very apparent that your talent is really in your interpersonal skills. And I have to mention, I don't know if you know this about me. I was a family court judge for 26 years. Did you know that?
I do. I love
Well,
that.
the reason I mention that is because the Robert Irvine Show was about 10 years ago, you hosted this daytime talk show. You resolved people's conflicts. And I was fascinated by your excellent mediation skills. Where did you get those skills?
It's funny, and Harvey, that was a blip in time. By the way, I'm going to tell you why I did that show, even though everybody told me not to do it because it wasn't the original show. It turned a little Jerry Springer meets Oprah meets, you know, a few
Yeah.
other
And you
women.
only did two seasons, and I knew there was a lot of toxicity, but your
It
mediation
was.
skills were skills that we judges were supposed to learn, and many of us couldn't do it as well as you.
Well, we did 180 episodes of that show in about 6 months. I was doing six episodes a day. And I'll tell you one of them. And again, 300 people in the audience, six shows a day, bullet points. But I really want to hear from the people. And this is, I'm going to answer your question in a roundabout way. I had a young man. He was 12 years old. His dad was incarcerated for drugs. His mother had a rap sheet as long as you can imagine. He'd stole iPhones. He was watching porn, all these things that he was doing. And we were the last hope. He'd been incarcerated as a 12-year-old. And he came on the show and he gave me a piece of paper, just like this. And I said, what's this? He said, read it. I said, you see this name? It says Robert Irvine. It doesn't say your name, does it? I said, you'll read it to me and the audience. So he read it with his head down. And I said, so, okay, so you're a bad kid. You've been incarcerated. You've done all these things. I want you to do me a favor. Get down, give me 20 push-ups. He said, well, I can't do 20 push-ups. I said, get down, give me as many push-ups as you can. He got to eight, and I put my hand under his chest, and I helped him do 20 push-ups. I stood him up, sat in my chair. I said, you see how easy it is when people help you? What do you want to do? And we came to this conversation, and it was about he wanted to join the military. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, here's my deal with you. If you do after school program, if you go to a church and feed people, if you get A's, I will promise you this, I will help you. So he said, okay, I'm willing to do this. I said, but here's the kicker. I'm going to call your school every week. No matter where in the world I am, I'm going to call your teacher. I'm going to call the church once we decide where you are, and I'm going to follow up with your mom. I did 6 months. I did my bit. 6 months, he did his bit. I kept up with him for 2 years. After a year, I said, okay, I'm going to invite you to the Pentagon. You can sit with the Medal of Honor recipients, you can sit with senior leaders, you can sit because you want to be in the army. And I put the chief and whatnot, I asked the chief to come and speak to him. He sat in there. His mother couldn't even get in the Pentagon because of a rap sheet. I had to have the chief of police allow me to bring that kid in with me as his parent, kind of for those 3 hours. He sat around the table. We made food in my restaurant. I said, you can ask any question you want from any of these people. He asked some amazing questions. You know what that kid's doing now? He's a sergeant first class in the United States Army.
That's
So,
incredible. They
out of
need
that,
people like you working in the jails.
right, out of those 76 people we sent to anger management classes, we had chefs stab their girlfriends with scissors. you know, all these people we put into anger management and to life lesson coaching and all those kind of things, we changed 76 lives. It was a little hokey, but this kid stands out to me because I deal so much with the military and I speak to him all the time. But this was a kid that the society had given away. I'll give you another one just briefly. The foundation just graduated 250 kids from Puerto Rico, kids that were last chance kids, 16 to 18 year old, no jobs, living in small houses, you know, with the electricity line, the extension cord to the main cord, you know, all those kind of hard stories. I know what poor is. I know why these kids were doing what they're doing, whether they were selling drugs, whether they were on the street, whether whatever. I stood there and watched 250 kids, all of which wouldn't got their GED, that got their GED, but 33 of those were 4.0 GPA. Those kids would have been left on the side of the street. We promised to get them jobs in the military, first responder, and we've got doctors, lawyers, teachers, all come from that program that would have been swept aside. And it's people taking interest. By the way, that program costs $7 million, which is nothing for 22 weeks and 250 kids to change a life.
And yet the governments can't do it in the jails. Let me assure you of that. I want to mention a very wonderful feature film that you executive produced, Hell or High Seas. It's a documentary about a U.S. Navy veteran with PTSD who sails around Cape Horn as a way to find healing and redemption. It's just a beautiful movie, sir. I loved it.
You know, it came to me. I wish I'd have been on the trip with him, Taylor Krieger. They had all this footage, didn't know what to do with it. And I didn't even know he was sitting in the room with me. And that's a true story. I watched all the footage. I'm like, well, yeah, but there's no means. There's no start, middle, and end to it. There's no story. And what from that movie, docu, whatever you want to call it, is exciting for me is I got to go back to his school with a team. And what you don't realize, he's a Navy rescue swimmer, jumping out of a helicopter, saving people, tried to commit suicide. The gun didn't go off, wanted to change. But the kicker to this was he was a remedial swimmer, 13 years old. He couldn't swim. He was with five-year-old kids. Yet that wasn't part of the story. And we went back to his school. He's got every record of every swimming on this whole board. Right. So I'm like, guys, we got to start. This is where it starts. Then progress. When I said that and Taylor was sitting there with shaggy hair and he's like, well, I'm that guy. I'm like, well, nice to meet you, but tell me your story. And he told me the story. And that's how I could piece together, go back to the things, you know, the squall off the coast of Florida, the fire, running out of money, getting drunk and fighting with his best friend who was selective duty, all these things. And you know what that kid's doing right now? And I'm so proud of him. Number one, he has a tequila brand. Number two, he's got boats that sail around the world races with veterans on legs of those races. So he's turned his hardship, suicidal thoughts into doing amazing things. And that's what we do at the foundation. I partnered with Elizabeth Dole, Face the Fight, which is something really special. And there's a lot more people, not just me or my foundation, but as veteran suicide is not 22 a day. And everybody says that, and I get so upset. We're triple digits in there. And it's because we put veterans in a box. And that was the whole reason that we went to Scotland, or we've been doing that for 11 years. This year we'll take 100 people. And if you go onto my website, which you've done all this research, you'll see the Catarán Yomp. Watch it after we finish this. It will change your life. It changes lives. It stops suicide by getting people out of a room around a tribe. When you leave the service or you leave a job after 30 years, you feel helpless, because you were part of something bigger than you. And then you go home, you sit there, and that's where all the evil starts to creep in of, you know, what I did years ago and whatever. On this yomp at mile 36 or mile 24, the evil comes out, we're there. We can do this. Have a you'll watch, please watch. But Simon failed the first 54 mile, broke down at mile 36 about all his past service. This year he went back with his wife, completed the 54 miles, completely different human being, part of our foundation, and has a will to give and keep giving. And I think I get all excited when I see this, when I do this, but it's so like you wake up every morning and you just know, I didn't get blown up. I didn't get shot. I didn't. And there's every guy, Mike Schlitz, 99% burns, two claws. He's on my foundation team. Just finished his 100th operation. He's got synthetic skin. He can't hold walking sticks. And if it rains, he's got to take his arms off.
The work of the foundation, the Robert Irvine Foundation, is monumental. It's very, very impressive that not only do you care about great food and great business, you care a lot about fitness. You are yourself astoundingly fit. You're the only chef I've ever seen who looks that good without his shirt on. But beyond physical health, it's obvious that you place enormous importance on mental and emotional health. That's very clear in your last two books, Family Table and Overcoming Impossible. I think you must be very well aware that the whole world was shocked by the passing of another celebrity chef, Anthony Bourdain. Did you read his book, Kitchen Confidential?
I did. And Anthony and I, it's so funny. And we have to also mention Anne Burrell, who just passed away, which was
devastating.
Devastating to me personally, because that was part of the suicide. That was what it was. She committed suicide. And same with Bourdain. I was with Bourdain, the Cayman cookout, and he was notorious for hating Food Network chefs because he was thrown off Discovery. He went to CNN, did an amazing job. He's an amazing human being, just all around. But he was in South Beach Food and Wine Festival, and he said to me on the stage in front of a couple of thousand people, oh, yeah, dinner slightly difficult. It was a dig at me, like dinner impossible. He said, oh, it's slightly difficult. And I said to him, hey, you want to come and do it? Psh, feel free. I'd love to have you. Show you how real it is, because it's as real as it gets in real life. And 2 years later, I'm doing Cayman cookout. He's on a hammock. I'd had a couple of drinks. It was a very expensive thing. It was great. He came up to me and said, that was the best demo I've ever seen. I'm like, thanks. We had a couple of drinks. He came to our dinner at night, and I started to form a real, like, he was a very unusual bird, but a great human being. Him and Eric Rupert. Eric Rupert, three-star Michelin, one of the most amazing people. So it was me, Emeril, Jose Andres, and Danielle, Eric Rupert, and a few, you know, other French chefs. And I would always walk three steps behind, because that's how much I revered these chefs. And Eric would always like push me into the mix. And I'm like, I'm not even worthy to be in this group of people, let alone take a picture and be cooking. So I met him. We started to get along, which was great. I didn't know him intimately, although I wanted to. I went to Scotland that year to do the yomp that I just mentioned. I was with four or five commander in our broth Scotland visiting them before the yomp. And I got a text to say Anthony had committed suicide. Devastation, same with Anne. Both had so much to give to the world, but so much personally, money, fame, outlets to do great things, but nobody knows, and this is why Face the Fight and the foundation is so important. Nobody can read your feeling. Even his best friend, Eric Rupert, was in the room next door.
But I asked you whether you read his book, Kitchen Confidential. Yeah. I wanted to know whether all those struggles that he referred to in his book, did they resonate with you in any way?
Oh, totally. And look, that was one of my first books when I came to the States, and a few others, by the way. But that's the hospitality industry, right? Those struggles of, look, I never did drugs. I've never smoked a cigarette or cigar. Did I drink alcohol? Yeah, I still do, but not, but I know when to cut it off. And then he had a different life bringing up than I did. And I can't speak to that. But when you read his writing, you always felt it was him. You were there with him, right? And when you write a book, it's very hard to get that feeling. But yeah, I mean, I come from that background. I wasn't rich. I wasn't, his family had more money than mine, for sure. He had a different upbringing. He worked in some great places. Mine was different. The struggles are still the same. And I think that's in any life. When you feel that you can't get ahead, or then all of a sudden you get projected into this,
Stratosphere.
yeah, this world that is like, whoa, what's going? I think it's almost like football players or basketball players. And I just read yesterday, funny enough, a young man, 21 years old, that's going to make 40 million a year playing football for Manchester United, or he's being transferred from Manchester United to another place. And I often wonder, who's taking care of their mental health, right? It's not, because the first thing you do is you spend money and you go crazy and you do all these, you get a fast car and you end up, smashing into a tree, or you all those things, because we're not used to that. We're not designed from going from kind of low level to that stratosphere in such a short period of time.
But you
And
seem to have handled it so well. You haven't been married 15 times. You
no.
haven't had all of these roller coaster experiences with fame. For some reason, you have a resilience and you have instincts about people and who to surround yourself with that have served you very, very well.
I think you just said something that hit a point there, and you can tell you're a judge. You surround yourself with people that are like-minded and smarter than you, that can hold you accountable. And my wife is one of them, by the way, and she's outside right now. But
Of course she is. She's Canadian.
my wife is one of them, and she holds me accountable. My team holds me accountable. It's never been about, you talk about, money and fame, and my world, look, I'm very comfortable. I don't flaunt it on TV. You won't see me posting pictures of fancy cars and big house, because I don't have them,
Yeah,
because
you
I'm,
don't act like a star. You are a star. You're a superstar, but you don't act like one. You're not a diva.
I just want to, look, I'm really easy. Find me a gym next to a Hilton Garden Inn or a Marriott. When we film, we don't stay in big hotels. Even when I travel with my wife, we stay in, although when we come to Toronto, I do love the Four Seasons in Toronto. I do love that. But we're very down to earth. My kids were grown or taught as young kids. And it's so funny because my young one, Talia, just graduated Rutgers. She takes the bar for criminal law in February for New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. And my other one, Annalise, who's 27, she's a pediatric speech pathologist in Johns Hopkins. And they've all been brought up with, service above self, quiet humility.
And values, obviously values.
Totally. But it's so funny because you're a judge, I'll tell you this story. My daughter, Talia, has been a public defender for many years.
And that's how I started out.
And she got a first case where she was in with a judge, and the judge said to her, "I need to sidebar with you. Come in my chambers, and what do you think about this kid?" And she said, "I think I've been to his home, I've been to his family, I've talked to his thing." And she said, he said, "Okay, come back out." And the judge told the offender, "I'm going to let you go based on her, like, understanding of you, but if I see you here, I'll double, triple, whatever your sentence next time." The kid's gone on to do great things, and I feel very proud of that, because they're both doing something in the service above self realm,
Well, the apple doesn't fall from the tree. Well, I only have one more question for you, sir. If you could go back and talk to that 15-year-old Robert Irvine when he was entering the Merchant Marines, what would you say to him?
Listen more.
Well, I
Listen.
have to tell you, it's been an immense honor meeting you and having this opportunity to chat with you about your really monumental life and career and the contributions you make to the world well beyond business, well beyond the food industry. Thank you so much, Chef, for taking the time to appear on our show.
Well, you are so welcome. And I will tell you this, we're in the middle of the modernization of the Joint Force feeding platform, taking on how we feed our servicemen. That's not been changed since 1940. And it's the most amazing thing to see legislative things that are put into place way back when that we have to change and we haven't touched it. So it's a fun time. I am here at your disposal, Steve's disposal, whatever you need. You know how to get a hold of us. And it's been a pleasure to spend some time with you. Hopefully we get to spend a little bit more time soon.
Thank you so much. Our guest has been the fabulous celebrity chef, author, entrepreneur, humanitarian, Robert Irvine. For more information about Mr. Irvine and to get some great recipes, buy his books and other merchandise, and find out about all his projects, please visit his official website, chefirvine.com. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you all for joining us. See you next time. Thank you to my producer, Steve Silver, my managers, Rick Marcelli and Robin Bragg Marcelli of the Marcelli Company in Hollywood, my director of programming, Robert Monaghan, my editor, Isaiah Sharalampadis, and my entire team at the XPTV One Network in the UK.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to check out all the great interviews on the Harvey Brownstone Interviews YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new videos are posted.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.